JSO Sheriff Mike Williams defends the eye-popping costs of JSO's public records. The Duval County School Board may sue the state over a controversial new education law, and more layoffs seem to be on the way at CSX. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download our WJCT app, listen to us there anytime, or on iTunes, or you can stream us live right now on Facebook. Get on the line now with all of your thoughts and questions as we break down the biggest stories of the week with our Friday roundtable, 549-2937. Then later, the works of Shakespeare on stage in Ponte Vedra this weekend. We'll tell you about a special show, and don't miss the live in-studio performance from Dave Matthews Band violinist Boyd Tinsley. Yeah, it's a preview of his band's big show tonight in downtown Jax. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday. Time for our weekly media roundtable as we welcome Ben Konark, reporter for the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Tim Gibbons is here, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
Charles Griggs of the Jacksonville Free Press.
Good morning.
Good to see you. And WJCT's own reporter extraordinaire, Lindsay Kilbride.
Nice to be here.
And lots to discuss this Friday. Everything from layoffs looming, yes, again, at CSX, to a possible lawsuit over Florida's new charter school law and more. We'll go over all of that in a moment, but here's our top story right now. And here's a question. How much should you have to pay to get access to public records here in Florida? Should they cost you, say, $314,000? Well, this is a flap that started earlier this week when local attorney John Phillips complained about the cost of public records he was seeking from police. Phillips is representing the family of Blaine Land. He was struck and killed by a JSO patrol car in May that was being driven by Officer Tim James. Attorney Phillips requested documents about James's history and others on the force. JSO responded with a letter stating the information would cost Phillips over $300,000. Now, Sheriff Mike Williams defended that high price tag earlier this week, saying that it would take JSO a massive effort to provide all of the information Phillips was asking for. So, we have a very open public records law in Florida. Are agencies fulfilling this, not just JSO, but others? This is something we've looked at a lot over the years, and right now we want your calls. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax or weigh in on our Facebook page. Ben Konark of the Times Union, let's begin with you. You've been covering this. Sheriff Williams saying, hey, maybe we didn't communicate this very well, but the cost of these records is worth $300,000, given what this attorney, John Phillips, was asking for. True?
I think that might still be an open question. I mean, there are, even if you look at the most recent cost breakdown provided by the sheriff's office, there are questions about the rate they're charging to get to that $314,000 number. I believe they're charging at the rate of the commanding officer of the Internal Affairs Unit, which, according to state law, you charge it by the rate of the lowest salaried person in the office who can pull the records. So we're still examining that cost breakdown to try to figure out whether that is an accurate number. But, you know, it certainly is a very wide-ranging request, so it could be.
Yeah, John Phillips was asking for a lot of information from police, which is what seemed to prompt the sheriff coming back saying, well, it's going to cost you.
Yeah, it is very difficult for an agency at this day and time to deny the intent of a public records request. What ends up happening, though, in real time is that people work together in order to fulfill the request. And it sounds like that didn't happen in this circumstances, where the attorney could possibly have been better served by having a conversation with those people providing the public records.
Right.
And then, you know, kind of whittling it down to actually what he was looking for.
Now, Barbara Peterson of Florida's First Amendment Foundation said this week that this $314,000 price tag is, in her view, a violation of Florida's public records law because it denies our constitutional right to access records.
And that's the idea. I mean, the law says you have to get the records, and if you're an agency who doesn't want to give them, you can't just not give the records. So as anybody who's dealt with public records, they can figure out ways to provide them, but not necessarily provide them in exactly the fashion you want or in the timeliness you want or for the cost that you want.
That's something we've seen over and over again with lots of agencies, right?
Yeah, I think my favorite one was once requesting some documents from the city and, you know, basically wanted all the documents on something, and they gave them to me in a box, not in folders or anything, just a box of paper that I believe they shook up before they gave me. So, you know, here's the records, have fun, you know, but they fulfilled the request, you know, not the spirit of the law, but the letter.
Yeah.
In this case, you know, sure, here's, you want the documents, you have to pay a lot.
549-2937. Lindsay Kilbride, going beyond the JSO and the flap this week over that, you know, Florida has a very liberal open records law, very strong sunshine law. And it's not one, I think it's fair to say, that a lot of government agencies really like. They don't like having to comply with requests, not just from reporters like us, but average citizens that want records.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. And I know that just from, you know, locals in the community through maybe the school district or, you know, with JSO, there are just citizens who make records requests. And they have contacted me before about the rates that they find outrageous. I think the thing that's hard to verify is if the rates they're charging you really measure up. Like, you know, it's really hard to look into that. You know, I've had estimates given to me before where I then went and found the information myself. It took me, you know, a lot less time than they were estimating it would take for me. And just, you know, it's going to cost, you know, $60 per 30 minutes or whatever, you know, figuring out how they come to that and really verifying that that's a decent rate or a fair rate, it's hard to do.
Usually if you provide access to those records, then folks will understand that they may not be all the records they're looking for. They're just looking for a few pages or a few documents out of 1,000 pages. They can have a way to review those. That would be more helpful in a circumstance like this.
What's interesting that Lindsay just brought up, though, is the you know, private citizens who make the request and deal with either a runaround or a high estimate where, to a certain extent, even as we talk about this, not a cynicism, but just kind of a world weariness of all of us have done, you know, all of us in this room have done public records requests and have dealt with that process. And we're kind of used to that dance, kind of used to the fight of, okay, you have to negotiate and you're going to get a high estimate and all of that. And we're also paid to do it to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Private citizen is just showing up going, something just happened with JSO. I want these records. They don't know the system. They don't know how much something should cost. They have no idea if the estimate is accurate. That's actually bad, you know, governance.
Ben.
To give you an example, for instance, I've been reporting on police shootings and talking to the mothers of people who were shot by police, and they often say, well, I tried to figure out what happened, and JSO tried to charge me $600. JSO tried to charge me $900 for this, and then they go to the state attorney's office and get it for free. So it does seem like, you know, as to Lindsay was kind of alluding to this, it does seem like there's something in particular about JSO where these records are, you know, especially hard to get. And to be fair to the sheriff, I think he recognizes that this is an issue. I think he's working on it. I know we've had meetings with him. I know they're currently trying to restructure their process. So we should, you know, give him the benefit of the doubt that this is something that he's working on. But clearly there's still some work to do.
And what about Phillips' point saying that, Sheriff Williams' point saying to honor Attorney John Phillips' request, his staff would have had to search every internal affairs record for the last 10 years. Is that accurate?
I really have a hard time believing that, and I can tell you why. You know, there are things written into the police union contract that make certain records that fall under the internal affairs unit, they no longer become public record after a certain time period. And I know I've made a request for all available public records referring to certain documents from that unit and gotten back, you know, an estimate of about $137 to search it. So it's really hard for me to kind of figure out where this number came from, and more importantly, where this process came from. It doesn't look like any public records process that I've ever been a part of. When I make a big request, I hear from them. And that's been my question all along. It's not so much about the number for me. It's about what led us to this number and how do we get here. And that, I think, is still an open question.
And it's not so much about the number, like you mentioned, but it is about the process. And it has to be open to members of the ordinary people from the public who want to come in and ask for information, because people don't know that they have a right to request this information and have a right to receive it, you know, in a reasonable amount of time.
All right, let's go to your calls on this. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we look at the biggest stories of the week. How concerned are you about the cost and difficulty of accessing public records here in Florida, particularly here in Jacksonville? 549-2937. Michael is in Jacksonville. Hey, Michael, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I got, you know, to give you a little insight on this. I'm actually in the record management document storage business. And I know there's a city contract right now, so I'm not really sure where the JSO records are stored, whether or not they're actually stored with JSO or with a commercial vendor. But typically, just to give you some ideas, if these records were cataloged properly and the JSO has an idea where what boxes these files are in, you can scan a whole box of records, document image them, and then make the documents within that box searchable so they can find exactly what they're looking for. And you're looking at about, on average, depending upon the paper, you're looking at about, say, $200 a box to scan. I'm driving, so I can't do the math. So if you take $350,000...
Neither can we, just so you know, and we're not driving, but go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
So, I don't know, how many boxes they're talking about. I mean, do the math, 300,000 divided by 200.
That would be 1,750 boxes.
Yeah, there. Yeah. There we go. Tim Gibbons, our business editor, calculated it very quickly in his head. But hey, Michael, thanks for that call. We appreciate that call.
Those records will still have to be inspected. And information redacted that wasn't so. You know.
And that's the and Ben talked about giving the sheriff his due. There is an interesting governance question as well of if you say that these records have to be reviewed because there is confidential things, there are things that are not public records. There is an argument that there's an attorney filing a lawsuit. He's obviously making money out of that, and the government should not take resources and use them for free on his behalf to do the redaction. That's why they charge, because it's going to be an employee going through it. As Ben pointed out, though, it's supposed to be the cheapest employee. It's not supposed to be, let's get the $1 million document reviewer person to come in and do it.
And they got that massive estimate by calculating, I think, 6,667 hours at that rate. So you think if you cut that rate in half, you cut that number in half, but it's still obviously a large number. But to the caller's question, I did ask about how the records were kept at the press conference, and I said, well, we're talking about 10 years, so going back to 2007, shouldn't this all be digital? And the sheriff said, yes, it should, and he indicated that it wasn't. So so we're not, I haven't been inside the records room. I don't know what the records look like, but I'll take the sheriff at his word for it that a lot of this is still kept in file cabinets.
Let me just jump in. I think that's probably the reality for most of our government agencies. They have not digitized.
Well, there's a guy named Mike who I think could probably help them out for $200 a box.
All right. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday roundtable. What are your thoughts on the top stories of the week? 549-2937. Give us a call. Now, also making headlines this week, the Duval County School Board says it may sue over a new state law many school districts say unfairly favors charter schools. The controversial law signed by the governor allows state money to incentivize charters to open in place of failing traditional public schools. And it also sets aside local tax dollars for building and maintenance projects to be shared with privately run charters. Several local members of our Duval School Board have raised concerns about these issues. The law is putting two of our local middle schools in danger of closing if they don't improve next year. Some other school districts around the state are going to sue over this. Whether Duval County or not will or not, though, is an open question. Lindsay Kilbride has done excellent reporting on this. Where do things stand with this, Lindsay?
They're still in discussions right now. So the bill, it's like a huge bill that passed at the last minute. It's almost 300 pages long. There's about 15 different bills in it. And it ranges from anything from allowing students to bring sunscreen to school without a doctor's note to accelerating the pace that schools get closed down if they're not doing well. Also, it has the charter schools of hope fund where they're incentivized to come in. And there's other things in there, like there's a standard charter school contract now. They've always had that contract, but they can't amend it now to fit the community's needs. Like if they really needed someone from staff to live in the city or something like that, if it's like a national company. So districts are arguing that it might not be, it might be unconstitutional. So there's a couple different phrases in the Constitution that they're referring to. One is that the school district is to operate, control, and supervise schools. They're saying that's essentially being taken away from them in this. It also has the school district is supposed to be a uniform, efficient, safe, blah, 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 high quality public schools. So it's, they're saying it's basically creating like a two-tiered system, that they have the charter schools with different rules than the public schools, one being like teacher certifications are different now for charter schools, things like that, where mm-hmm. they're basically saying that's two different school districts, so it might be unconstitutional. So now they're still talking about it. Some school board members are, we have to go in right now. And
we have to fight this.
Yes, and join up with other districts.
How many districts are suing, by the way?
Two so far, but others, a lot of others are in the talks. So right now, a lot of school districts are meeting about it. So
we could see local school boards just rising up in defiance of the legislature. Thought. That's the big picture, right?
Yeah. I think it's Broward and St. Lucie.
St. Pinellas.
Like Broward and Pinellas, so South Florida and Tampa.
Yeah, so anytime you have a controversial law that passes with no real implementation guidelines, or very few, you're begging for a lawsuit. And in this situation, the district is probably, they're probably going to be in good standing with their constituents if they don't examine this closely enough to see if there's possibility for them to get some redemption here. Mm-hmm. At least if some of them have some of their policies ironed out.
And what about some of the others on the local school board saying, oh, let's not do anything. They could retaliate against, the legislature could punish us. They could retaliate.
Yeah, a few members actually have concerns about that, but the one school board member who is basically saying, I don't want to go into a lawsuit, like he's not really considering it at this point, is Scott Shine, who basically said that there's going to be negative repercussions if we do this. He also said, you know, if other school districts are already going in this lawsuit and they win, we still reap the benefits from that without damaging our relationship with state lawmakers.
Oh, yeah. I know I often talk about being cynical about people here on the show, but so basically, oh, there might be repercussions. We wouldn't want that. So, hey, you and him should fight.
He's saying since they're already doing that. But then he also said, like, let's meet with the Duval delegation. They are planning to do that regardless. But some of the other school board members who were in Tallahassee frequently are like, we educated them. They knew they still passed this law. Meeting with them again is not
the lobbying over this was intense on both sides. What do you think about local school boards suing the state over this new law around charter schools? 549-2937. And this fight over charters is particularly heated in Florida, Ben and the rest of you guys, but it's by no means unique to Florida. We're seeing this play out all over the country as traditional public schools are arguing these laws are weakening their revenue stream, weakening their ability to educate. The charter side is saying we are just responding to the demands of parents who want these options.
There's an interesting, I don't know, just the phrasing that we use of the idea that Tallahassee was lobbied heavily on this, and clearly the school board's against it. And you know, it does appear that there are some very good charter school companies out there. There are some that are not as good, and the school board has made its opposition clear. And the way that we do stuff now is you have a lawsuit to kind of have that fight. And it almost makes their threats empty in the future if they don't go through with this. It becomes, well, you know, so next time when you show up and go, don't do this or we'll do nothing, it's kind of a hard position to be in.
That was my takeaway from reading the coverage too, is it just seems, you know, it just seems like they're skirting their responsibility if they don't advocate for their students, right? Exactly. So to be concerned about grants is totally legitimate, but that shouldn't get in the way of doing your job.
Well, some people would consider the fact that the legislation passed and was signed in the first place to be retaliation against the work they've done and the work they're trying to do. They really have almost no choice but to look at this close enough to see if there are other options for standing up for the way they're trying to do business here in Duval County.
And Scott Shine's point was he believes that 7069, that's the bill's number, that was in retaliation to, you know, whether it was unions or other school districts voting against charters. He thought that was a repercussion and, like, it's just going to get worse if we join in on a lawsuit. But the school board chair, Paula Wright, for instance, she's saying we need to go into the next legislative session with a lawsuit saying we're serious about this. For her, she's saying hopefully it is found unconstitutional. And then there's also the rule that bills can only be about one subject matter, although that they could, I think, theoretically just kind of break it up and that would fix it. So they really want it to be found unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. We'll continue to follow it. Meanwhile, if you're just tuning in, it's our Rockin' Friday Media Roundtable as we discuss the top stories of you guys are rockin'. As we discuss the top stories of the week, give us a call at 549-2937. Here's a question to callers. How do you feel about term limits? Do you like the idea of throwing the bums out, like, all the time? You know, as soon as possible. People say that a lot, right?
Well, here's an elective. Just throw them out before they
Here's the question. Should our local officials be term limited out as they are now, or should they get to stick around longer? Yeah. Jacksonville elected city officials would be able to serve three consecutive terms in office instead of the current two under a proposal being considered in city council. Bill sponsor Matt Schellenberg says officials term out right as they're figuring out their jobs and getting their stride, and that staying longer in office would mean better work product from them. Now, if this thing passes, it wouldn't just be the city council that could stay three terms. It would be school board members, other officials like the sheriff, property appraiser, supervisor of elections. What do you think? Should people get to stay in office longer or not? Give us a call at 549-2937. And by the way, if city council approves this, the voters will decide in the 2018 ballot. So ultimately, it's up to all of us to decide this.
Yeah, we're terming out in 8 years, getting to know their jobs, some of those council members may argue that they know how to do their jobs in their first term.
Yeah.
So the optics on this probably would have been better if this legislation was presented by a first-term council member than a second-term council member, even though I know he said he's not going to run if it passes. But it'll be tough for people to kind of sort of agree with a three-term city council, especially when it took everything to get them to where they are now.
What do you mean it took everything to get them to where they are now?
Well, it was a big fight.
When did they enact term limits before?
That was back in the 90s.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was 25 years ago.
I find it interesting. So the mayor isn't under term limits in Jacksonville, right?
Yes, or is he?
No, he is.
Okay. So how many?
Two terms.
Two terms. Okay.
All right. Because, you know, being from, you know, Vermont, I think the only term limits we have are on a governor. And I do think it might be more important to have that on an executive than a legislative office.
Yeah. And, you know, other cities around, like, for example, the Southeast, I think Charleston, South Carolina, if I'm not, correct me if I'm wrong, people listening, but I think the guy's been in office for decades.
Yeah, and you have those cities. I mean, you know, the Midwest has a lot of those, you know, cities and towns where it's just somebody gets in the power and sticks around forever. What's interesting is it would change the entire cycle that people go through now, which, if you look at Jacksonville politics, tends to be you're on city council, you go to the state legislature, maybe you get one of the, you know, elected sort of offices here, and you kind of cycle through all of that. Having four more years on city council would obviously change that. What I find interesting is the argument that you can't truly wrap your arms around city government until you've been in there 6 years, say, so middle year.
You're not
term,
buying that argument.
Well, I can see, you know, on a state level, obviously, we think a state legislator can get his arms around it much more quickly. Jacksonville's a big city. It's a complicated budget. You know, I've read through the thing. Do we really think that somebody coming in who has the wherewithal to get elected can't get their arms around the issues, particularly the council, the district council people who really are concerned with their district and kind of by definition should, you know their district's concerns when they get elected?
Yeah. And by the way, this applies, as Ben pointed out, to all of our officials, mayor, sheriff, election supervisor, council members, school board members, you name it. Lindsay, as we've seen officials on the school board come and go, that there's been discussion about the fact that these folks are paid a salary. These are paid positions, and some of them treat it like a full-time job, even though that's been the criticism in the past, even though it's not a full-time job.
Right. I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't really have an opinion. I think the thing is the voters will decide, yeah. You know, and there is a good point, which is that they have already decided, which has been a lot of the, you know, argument, which is we've already decided this. You know, there are pros and cons to both.
Well, treating it like a full-time job isn't a bad thing, except that some of them don't have the luxury of it, you know, having a luxury opportunity to do other things. But it's a complicated job. It's very difficult.
It is.
And trying to
but
do
what, it. What about the argument that's been raised that they're supposed to be, at 30,000 feet, providing oversight, not spending all day, every day, delving deeply into the weeds of – what administrators are doing.
That comes from leadership. So, you know, the council leadership will sort of drive that train and help make sure that that's not occurring on a regular basis. They can steer that as they go through the committee process.
When you talk about leadership, it actually just should be mentioned that this particular city council does have a lot of newbies on it, that the city council we have now would not be the city council we have now if there were term limits, that, you know, term limits had a sea change in the last election, and we have a lot of new blood. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that's good or bad, simply that it is a result of term limits as more people get to join the process.
All right, let's go to lots of calls on this one. Judy in Jacksonville. Hi, Judy, go ahead.
Yes, the masses are happy with the result, then why shouldn't the masses be able to vote on it each time if they say yes?
That makes sense.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Rich in Middleburg. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, yeah, I'm against this. It seems to be a movement that they want to repeal this two-term limit and go to three. But I agree with the panelists that I don't buy this. It takes 4 years to get your arms around a job. Every job I ever had, if you weren't up to speed in 6 months, you were out of there. It's just nonsense.
All right. Thanks, Rich. Mike in Arlington. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I have two comments. The first one is the fact that the way our Constitution was written, it was really written to have people, farmers and shopkeepers and such, get involved with the government and then get out of the government and go back to work by making term limits, you know, making three times. I can't believe that it takes people 12 years to get into their stride on learning how to do their job. I understand it's a part-time job, but they came into office after making some criticism or having some idea of what they were planning on doing, because that's how they got elected. So how can they not get their act together in 12 years? In fact, if they can't get their act together in 12 years, that should be the reason to get them out of the city council.
don't have term Mike. Limits, but have like a test of, is your act together? And, it's interesting, though, that idea of...
Man, we're getting some very nice unfiltered opinions on this one.
So you look at the past two mayoral administrations where... Alvin Brown came in and had basically the same checklist that Lenny Curry did of, you know, pension reform and restructure government and do these things, and arguably got some of it to a certain point by the end of his first 4 years and then got unelected. Curry came in again with a very limited checklist and said, okay, it's going to be pensions and downtown stuff, and is moving ahead on that. Whether or not you like the direction he's moving in, he definitely has gone down his checklist and isn't, you know, waiting around to his second term to get stuff done, which was a sense that Alvin Brown was trying to get the pieces in place and the second term was going to have, you know, everything happen, and then he didn't get a second term. Depending on the approach, you can come in and hit the ground running.
And a clear contradictory indicator to this whole piece, this whole legislation, is that you have a first-term city council member who is the sitting council mm-hmm. president. So if...
Anna Brochet.
So if she doesn't know what she's doing, she got to wait till, you know, so that sort of seems to contradict what the legislation is asking.
All right, Eric on the south side. Hi, Eric. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and good morning, all. I'm not only against expanding term limits, I'm against running for more than one city office ever. You run one time, it's tax assessor, and you're done. And the most egregious example I can recall of this is Tommy Hazzuri. The guy's made millions of dollars when he was on the school board for 8 years. And by the way, Melissa, it's not just salary of $40,000 a year. Back in his term, it was $35,000. They get a state contribution towards their pension. They get health insurance paid completely. I mean, we can't afford this, and they just do round robin. I mean, it's crazy. And thanks, Melissa, for taking calls after 9:30. I can't remember after years of listening to you that you take calls after 9:30.
Oh no, yeah, we do a lot actually. But thanks. I'm glad you were able to get on with us. I don't think Hazzuri's made millions, but what about his comment that a lot of officials they hop from public post to public post. And they can, by the way, they can build up a pension doing that.
Yeah, I think the last two callers have really gotten at the heart of why term limits appeal to people, is because there's a kind of natural inclination to recoil to the idea of a career politician, right? You spend your entire life moving through the ranks. And so I think that that's kind of the point of term limits. You get fresh blood, you get new ideas, and, mm-hmm. and you kind of you battle influence that way.
Well, I think there is a I found it weird. Like, I've been in Jacksonville for a long time, but growing up in the Northeast, where we didn't have some of these elected positions, they were just appointed, where there is an oddity to basically getting elected to a job. You know, so council person, you can argue about whether it should be a full-time job or not, but like supervisor of election, that's a job. Mm-hmm. And people get elected to those positions and move around, and some of them are very qualified in those jobs, and that's why voters want them in another job. But people do end up not taking a break from their private career to do public service. It's that basically they're a professional politician / bureaucrat bouncing from job
for
to
life.
Job. That does rub some people the wrong
and
way.
And especially with positions like that, it is kind of odd, because how does the public really know if you're going to be a good supervisor of elections? You know, it's different.
You don't have strong opinions on what the property appraiser should do?
Okay, speaking of people losing their jobs, in business news this week, it looks like more pink slips are coming to CSX, sadly. CSX CEO Hunter Harrison is warning that the Jacksonville-based railroad could lay off another 700 employees this year. Tim Gibbons, business editor, Harrison, saying he's, you know, been streamlining operations at the railroad giant to make the company more profitable. That's what he's known for.
Yeah, for making it more efficient. It, I don't think, you know, obviously those layoffs and the people and the families who are affected is a horrible thing for people going through that. I don't think that the announcement is in and of itself a surprise. Hunter Harrison came in. He is known for making railroads more efficient, and more efficient means doing the same or more work with fewer people. His entire thing is he's supposed to make the railroad expenses lower, and the way you do that is by getting rid of people. So the people who have those jobs, this is obviously a trying situation, but and it's bad for Jacksonville. I mean, you look at Jacksonville downtown real estate, we're trying to get more people to move downtown. Well, all of those people who worked at CSX headquarters who no longer work downtown, they're not looking to live in the urban core.
And Wall Street downgraded CSX stock. The shares fell more than 5% over this announcement.
They did. They dropped about $5 since their peak about a week ago. So there has been a drop. But do keep in mind that peak on I think it was exactly a week ago, literally was their peak, the highest that their stock price has ever been. Harrison came in. Wall Street loves the guy. So there's it's definitely fallen, but you have to put that in a context. I'm not even sure what the context necessarily is, but the idea of falling from your all-time peak isn't the same as falling, just on a random day.
All right.
He's a fixer. And whenever you hear the word efficiency, that usually means layoffs. So,
finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida, the Gator edition. Mm-hmm. Yeah, only in Florida does a man keep the head of the alligator that attacked him.
That's similar, friend.
Yes. Did you hear about this? Longtime Jacksonville resident Scott Lahodic was nearly killed by a gator as he was working at his job diving for golf balls in a pond. The alligator put Lahodic into what the diver called a death roll, but he fought him off and was able to summon help. Still, he needed 400 stitches and staples to get patched up and faces months of rehab. But Lahodic is in good spirits and even asked the trapper for the animal's head, which he took as a trophy and has named Gator Bait.
When does the Adam Sandler movie come out on this?
Only in Florida does a man drive into a Lowe's store and just start cutting lumber. The unidentified man drove his vehicle through the back of the Lowe's in Gainesville, through those hanging plastic strips at the loading dock, just drove his car right in there. Entered the area, took out a circular saw, and just started cutting wood. And he even threatened employees who tried to intervene. The man has been Baker-acted.
Oh, shocking.
Nice. Finally, only in Florida is a man arrested for rummaging through the home of a famous Keys resident. No, not Ernest Hemingway's house. But 37-year-old David Murphy of Phoenix was caught on surveillance cameras going through the home of August Bush IV. He was spotted drinking beer from the fridge, even. We assume they were Budweiser's. Murphy told police he has no memory of the incident and was drinking all day and woke up in the home of the beer scion, August Bush IV, who I did not know had a house in the Keys. But now you know that.
That seems like karma. If you're drinking all day, if there is a house you should break into, it
might as well be that one. Yeah. That's right.
I was just telling you before the show why I love living in Florida.
And that's one of the reasons why.
Yeah, love the news.
Pat's Blue Ribbon.
Thank you, Lindsay Kilbride, Tim Gibbons, Charles Griggs, and Ben Konart. Guys, have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you. Thanks.
We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air.
Are you originally from here?
Yeah.
You live near here?
Yep.
So where are you from?
Honestly, it doesn't matter what I say because this isn't going anywhere.
Season 2 of the HBO series Insecure begins Sunday with its main character Issa back on the dating scene. We'll hear from Issa Rae, who co-created and stars in the series. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street. This week, I speak with Brett Anderson. He's restaurant critic at the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He introduces the new New Orleans that offers Israeli food right alongside Creole, Cajun, and 100 other cuisines. We also offer a taste of West African food with Zoe's Ghana Kitchen. And Dr. Aaron Carroll argues against a low-salt diet. Coming up this week on Milk Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday mornings at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A, and I am coming to WJCT Studios for a free listening party for younger public radio listeners. They'll be featuring a Skype Q&A with me, thought-provoking conversation, and refreshments, of course. The event is on Tuesday, July 25th from 6 to 8 p.m. Registration is free, but you do have to sign up. You'll find more online at wjct.org/events.
Sponsored in part by Firehouse Subs.
The very best of modern folk and acoustic alternative music tonight on String Theory. Listen to String Theory this evening at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Tune in, find out.
Welcome back. It's a fast-paced, hilarious production celebrating the works of Shakespeare. Yes. Apex Theater Studio Inc., in partnership with the Pontevedra Concert Hall, presents the complete works of William Shakespeare, abridged, live this weekend. Director Ian Mayers and cast member Robert Reed join us now with a preview. Good morning, my friends, thine friends.
Thine friends. I should say we're in the South, so it's fast-paced and hilarious. It's hilarious, Melissa.
So Shakespeare with a Southern twang, huh?
Shakespeare with a Southern twang and like 20 shots of espresso and a couple slugs of whiskey.
Oh, I see. Sounds like fun. Robert Reed, who do you play in this show?
Oh, who
do you play all kinds of all parts? Do you play Romeo? Do you play King Henry? Like, who all are you playing in this?
20 different characters.
Wow.
And 7 wigs.
Yes. Several wigs, all kinds of costume changes.
A kilt. Prosthetics.
Yep. Lots of sweat.
A squirt gun.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Shakespeare, but like you zip through all the different plays?
We do all 37 plays in 90 minutes.
Get out of here.
The longest running comedy hit on London's West End.
Get out of here.
And it's hilarious. And then a few years ago, the
authors updated. How do you make it funny? How do you make all these serious plays funny?
Oh, where do we begin? I think my favorite is the Scottish play, which is done kind of as a Braveheart takeoff with golf clubs and kilts.
And Scottish accents.
And really
bad
Scottish accents.
What's that, Macbeth? It's supposed to
be Macbeth? We don't say that in the theater, Melissa.
You don't call it Macbeth?
We don't say that word.
Okay, so this is a way for people to get into Shakespeare that might not want to actually see the real Shakespeare.
Yeah, it was an opportunity for me to get into Shakespeare. I know nothing about Shakespeare, and it has been a great learning experience, and I think that's what's great about the show is if you don't know anything about Shakespeare, this isn't a great format for you to learn about Shakespeare.
Yeah, and you'll have some fun.
Yeah, and if you hate Shakespeare, you'll still love the show.
And Apex Theater Studio is doing this. You've been very busy with that.
Yes, this is our fourth summer and our second summer at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall, thanks to Ryan Murphy and his amazing crew out in St. John's County. And we wanted a show that was rowdy, fun, something you could sit in the air conditioning and just giggle to and saunter up to the full deluxe bar there. Have a festive beverage and just laugh yourself silly.
And let's listen to a little music. The Young Step, you have a band. You're going to have an in-house band at this gig.
Young Step's opening for us tonight.
Yeah, and we're going to listen to a little of them as we keep talking. This is what they sound like. Sound great.
Oh, they're just so groovy. And they will create the vibe that is needed. The much needed vibe.
And the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall is a great venue, by the way. People have never been out there.
Right.
That's a nice venue. Now, Robert, you used to be with Second City in Chicago, right?
That's correct.
So yeah. You're an improv genius.
Yes,
do you
I
improv
am.
A lot of this Shakespeare stuff on stage?
You know, there's definitely scripted parts, but that's what I love so much about the show. It's just the freedom to kind of go and do whatever I want in those scenes. Ian was very generous to invite me to the show because it is the format that I really enjoy.
Right, and Robert's been on Swamp Radio for the past two years.
That's another Ian Mayer's production.
It's true. I'm the Orson Welles of Platka. Anyway, so I just noticed immediately his gifts and said, like, we have to put him in this show, along with Jason Nettle, who also has an improv background, Upright Citizens in New York, and Emily Awater, who's also a Swamp Radio regular. They make up the cast, and Chase Pittman, a student at Ponte Vedra High School. We need to include him.
Rising
improv star.
And you're the director of this whole thing, so you know it's going to be good.
It's just like herding cats, let's be honest. I mean, it's four comedians. They do what they want.
Can you give us any lines that you get off in this show?
I mean, I do enjoy the Scottish voice. I could give
do
you
the Scottish
voice.
Yeah,
do that real quick. That,
yeah. See you, Jimmy, and know that Macduff was from his mother's womb untimely ripped. What do you think about that?
Nice. Do you mention haggis in this production?
Because I am referred to as haggis breath, so yes.
Nice. You know, if it's not Scottish, it's crap. I mean, that's well
Amen.
Known.
I agree. Exactly.
Thank you, Mike Myers. All right. Ian Mayer's one of my favorite people ever, director of the complete works of William Shakespeare Abridged, and cast member and star Robert Reed. Guys, have a wonderful time.
Thank you. Used to. It's hilarious, remember.
That's right. Get your tickets now at apextheaterjax.com.
pvconcerthall.com.
Yeah, pvconcerthall.com. The show is this weekend. Thanks, guys, for being here.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
In a moment, a live performance from violinist Boyd Tinsley. Don't miss it. We'll be right back.
Next time on 1A, the global edition of the Friday News Roundup. Syria's rebels are told to expect much less help from the CIA. The White House unveils new sanctions against Iran and Venezuela, and the BBC comes clean on what its top talent is paid. We'll wrap up what's going on around the world on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Summertime is learning time. WJCT and the Jacksonville Public Library are partnering to help families fight this summer slide with educational programming and online resources that encourage learning at home. Log on to wjct.org/education/summer to find summer reading lists, activity books, early literacy development tools, and much more. Help your child prepare for the new school year at wjct.org/education/summer.
I'm Christian McBride, and this week on Jazz Night in America, it's the music of the genius, Ray Charles, played by the men and women who hit the road with him throughout his career, including
Ray Less
with Diane Shore,
also known as Deedles.
It's a family reunion at Jazz Lincoln Center in the name of Ray. Check it out this week on Jazz Night in America. 50 cents more than I'm gonna keep.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, he is known as one of the all-time greatest violinists in rock. Boyd Tinsley is the violin player for the Dave Matthews Band. But he also tours with his own band, Crystal Garden. That's who we're listening to right now. They sound amazing. Now, Tinsley and Crystal Garden are in town this weekend. They're doing a performance tonight at 1904 Music Hall in downtown Jacksonville. We've got a live in-studio preview right now as we welcome Boyd Tinsley and Crystal Garden to Studio 5. Hey, guys, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to you.
So good to have you on the show. This is so exciting. Now, Boyd, people know your work, of course, through the Dave Matthews Band. I mean, think of Ants Marching. They're just these crazy violin solos. You're so talented. But you have your own band. Tell us about Crystal Garden.
It's a band that I dreamed of putting together for years. I went out and fortunately sort of ran into these guys in different situations and said, wow, this is a guy that I want to be in my band. And got three guys, Michael Wasserman on vocals, Charlie Santos on bass, and Matt Fruin on drums. And, you know, they got to my house. We did an album together at my studio, and now we're on tour. They started off the tour with a Canadian tour in the winter, and now we're on a southern tour in the middle of summer.
Oh, man. So, sorry.
But no. But actually, it's nice. It's really been a great tour, and we've had some great gigs and run into some great people. So it's been a great tour.
So a new album and a chance for people to hear you tonight performing at 1904 Music Hall. Pretty exciting.
Yeah, it is. You know, I mean, like I said, this is their first foray down south, and obviously this is their first time in Florida. So,
and what's the name Crystal Garden reference?
It has to do with my studio, and around it there's a lot of crystals, quartz crystal embedded in the ground. And Charlie, our bass player, when he first came to the studio out there, like discovered that and picked all these quartz crystals and lined them up along the deck that I have. And people throughout the session always had a crystal with them. And so they called this place that, you know, my studio's on, the Crystal Garden.
Oh, nice. Your violin playing is so extraordinary. Anyone who's a fan of Dave Matthews Band has heard it and loved it. How do you see your instrument as, you know, incorporating into this genre of, you know, rock music?
I mean, there's some, you know, violinists that you can sort of go back to and sort of, you know, learn from. People like Stefan Grappelli, who's a great jazz violinist, Jean-Luc Ponte, as far as rock, Papa John Creech with Jefferson Airplane. But you can go borrow from these guys who were predecessors. And the violin, it wasn't for a long time that prevalent in music, like particularly from the 80s through to the 90s. But there's a whole new generation now of violinists and rock music that are coming forth. So, you know, I mean, my whole thing is just, you know, discovering the you know, new journeys within the instrument.
Sure. Well, we can't wait to hear it because we have a special treat as Boyd Tinsley and Crystal Garden perform now live in studio. It's a preview of their show tonight at 1904 Music Hall. What are you guys playing?
It's a song that the band wrote called People.
Here they are, Crystal Garden.
I believe we'll fly past the sun if we're around long enough to get the job done. You perceive with shuffles and ones with the strength of kings and queens and all the people are just people. Sometimes evil. Revolution. All the news, and it seemed we had to won't measure up to the weight of all this. People are just people, sometimes good, sometimes evil. Sometimes good, sometimes evil. All wondrous variety in all creation. And in the lies of day, I pray we build a better way. Cause people are just people, and we'll keep learning.
Crystal Garden and Boyd Tinsley, thank you so much doing this performance with us. We just are thrilled to have you guys.
Thank you so much.
Beautiful. Go see Crystal Garden tonight at 1904 Music Hall in downtown Jacksonville. It's a special show. Amazing music to close out the week here on our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again Monday at 9 a.m. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.